Hello. My name is Nicolette Ladico. I'm in New York City, and today is Thursday, December 3rd, 2020. And I'm joined via Zoom conference by Lisa Aristia, who I will interview as part of the Oral History Summer School's Education Narratives Initiative. Lisa, will you please introduce yourself and let me know where geographically you're joining this Zoom call from?
My name is Lisa Aristia, and right now I'm in upstate New York, in Columbia County, right on the Massachusetts border.
Thank you. Well, it's such a pleasure to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you today. Thank you so much for agreeing to participate in the Education Narratives Initiative project. As you probably know, began earlier this year, and for sharing your experience as an educator during this time. We felt that this was an incredibly important story to uplift the story of educators in the time of the COVID crisis. I'm thinking about someone who will listen to this interview in the future, and I want to make sure that they know who you are so they have some context about you. So to begin, can you tell me a little bit about you and what path led you to being an educator?
So I've been in education since 1991 or 92, I think. I started as, actually I was a foster care caseworker for Family of Woodstock in Kingston, New York. And I was working for a special program for, to teach independent living skills to foster care kids. But it really meant like you were a DSS, a Department of Social Services caseworker. During that time, I became trained using, I think it was called the Equity Model. So if anybody out there who knows the work of Julius Lester, a pretty famous African-American author who's no longer with us, his wife, Joan Lester, created the Equity Institute, which was kind of like a bias awareness training site. Two people who were friends with her and were her major trainers then found me and trained me in the same kind of model. And we were really kind of on the cutting edge, I think, back then, in the early 90s, doing that kind of work. And a lot of the work ended up being in schools. And so I was doing bias awareness workshops and conflict resolution workshops, and I got trained to teach kids from kindergarten to 12th grade how to be peer mediators. And so I was really spending, I think I've been in over 100 New York City schools and upstate New York rural schools. Or more than that, probably like 200, because I was working every day as a consultant. And I was just in school so much that I made a decision while riding the Metro North from the city to Poughkeepsie. And then, you know, you take the car over the bridge, blah, blah, blah. This is when I was living in Ulster County. I made the decision because I was reading a lot of Jonathan Kozol and a lot of Bill Ayers. And I just was like, I gotta be in these classrooms every day. I can't just like come in for a 6-week contract or a 2-week contract and then be out. And especially the way the schools were then, I mean, it was intense. I mean, they were crumbling and, you know, you had to bring your own toilet paper and there were rats and just, it was disgusting. I mean, the way they treated children, they called them animals. It was horrible. So I was like, I gotta be in schools every day. I want like relationships with kids and I wanna be there for them every day and interact with them. And so then it took me 12 years to get my undergraduate degree, almost the same to get my PhD. But after I finally got my undergraduate degree, I was able to apply to independent schools. And I myself attended an predominantly white, very wealthy independent school called the Lenox School. It's now called the Birchwathen Lenox School in New York City on the Upper East Side. And so I went back sort of into that kind of a community at Marin Academy in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I have to say that the 5 years I spent there, I was the director of diversity, community outreach, and service learning, and I taught English. Those were probably the best 5 professional years of my life. It was a very special place, very challenging. PBS, me, KQED made a documentary about my class and my collaboration with another teacher who was a public school teacher in San Francisco. All my best friends are still out there. It was a very creative time back in the Bay Area. So from there, my head of school there, her name is Bodie Brizendine. She's now the head of Spence, which is an all-girls independent school in New York City. She always said to me, oh, one day you're going to be a head of school. And I was like, no way, I don't want your job. Like, there's absolutely no way. That is so not happening. She's like, yes, it will. And I was like, no, it's not going to happen. And then it happened. So I tried to start a school. I did start a school in Chicago under Arne Duncan, who that was before he was Secretary of Education under Obama. It was when he was the equivalent in New York, where you called the superintendent, but chief operating officer of Chicago Public Schools, very formidable, just as sort of neoliberalism was burgeoning. My school started as one of a series of schools that began when some Mexican mothers went on a hunger strike to create schools in their community, because their community school had like something like 2,000 kids, but it was built for like 800. And Arne Duncan and the mayor and the rest of the folks had basically in many ways stolen about $70 million from them. And after the hunger strike, it was like supposedly all over the newspapers or whatever, they created 4 new schools. Mine became this like fifth little school. There's one other little school. And then they punished. then I have to say they punished me for it. Like it was a harrowing time in Chicago. Chicago is very still much like Capone Town. Quid pro quo, and I couldn't put my integrity away. And that was a problem. The only way to make it there is really if you put your integrity in your pocket and you're ready to play politics. And I wasn't. And so they did things like, you know, I'd call 3 times a day, because all of my students were free and reduced lunch students. They never sent me a refrigerator. They never sent me a cafeteria worker. They never sent food. So I spent almost $10,000 of my own savings feeding the children and doing everything. It was just backbreaking. I mean, I probably worked 20 hours. It was just a crazy time. And finally, I did win the charter. And then within a month or something like that of winning the charter, somebody cut a backroom deal, and I only found out that I didn't get the charter because like the newspapers called me. Like it had been put in the newspaper that basically I got the charter. And then the newspaper called me and said, so how do you feel about not getting the charter? And I was like, wait a minute, we just reported that we got the charter. And then CPS, Chicago Public Schools, called me up and they said, we're so sorry to say that, you know, you're not going to get the charter, which means that you don't get the $250,000 that you need. So, but we still want you to stay open. And I said to them literally, on what, air? Like I need that $250,000. I said, I'm shutting it down. So I called in every favor and moved every child to as good a school as I possibly could, and shut the school down. And then moved to Minnesota. Got married, came back to, we went all different places because my husband's a professor and a writer. Then I ran the middle school at the United Nations International School. I was principal there. And then Then I did 5 years at SUNY Albany, University at Albany, teaching. And I have to say, actually, those were pretty glorious years. I probably had 10 glorious years in education. Those students were phenomenal. And they're the reason why this, my own archive is just burgeoning and growing. And so after 5 years there, I was like, I think I better get back in the field. You know, I've been teaching. So then I became head of upper school at Brooklyn Friends School in downtown Brooklyn, New York. And that was intense. And then the pandemic hit us, and I myself got COVID, and but I, not the kind where you get hospitalized. And then June 30th was my last day, which is kind of the normal cycle. And I started, now I'm an assistant, tenure track assistant professor at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in the Department of Education. Basically in a licensure program, doing everything that I wrote my dissertation against. So, I mean, I can't, I ended up, you know, like I was like against the state, you know, against high stakes testing, and now I've got to like teach teachers how to do all that stuff. It's terrible. But anyway, so that was a long, long ass winded way of telling you how I got to where I am now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I wonder how some of particularly your early experience in Marin and your experience in Chicago and how different they were. Can you talk a little bit about how those formed your approach to education today? Maybe more your PhD dissertation approach as opposed to what you're teaching now.
Well, the PhD came out of what happened, what I saw could happen in education when I was at Marin Academy, and then what I saw could happen in education when I was in Chicago. And so much of the dissertation is on what happened in Chicago and about what was called Renaissance 2010, which was Arne Duncan's idea. And it basically was a whole privatization movement. And it was, you know, a coalition of land, labor, and money. So we're gonna knock down all the projects. We're gonna put up, you know, mixed income housing, which really means we're gonna ship all the black and brown people out to the suburbs and give them no way to come back, because we're gonna erect like $350,000 to $500,000 townhomes, which they can never afford. We're gonna build many more charter schools. And so you've got land, labor, and money all working sort of together. So that has brought me, and now like teaching against everything that I believe in, and that I fought through, is extremely disappointing, I will say. But let's just say if I were doing a PhD again, I had a couple of graduate PhD professors who had done like some undercover work, like one who went undercover on Wall Street. And then she wrote like some famous book about it or whatever, you know? And I'm like, this would be a really great time to get a second PhD and go undercover and be like, this is what it's like to really, this is what the state has really done to education. And when I say state, I mean the S, small state, and then the big state, right? Big S state, okay. But I think that I am, it's terrible to say, but I'm highly disappointed in education. I see it, I created and ran an institute called the Minneapolis Teachers Institute in Minneapolis for 4 or 5 years, where I had incredible teachers, some of whom I'm still connected with. I think almost like 100 or 200 teachers came through there. We'd meet monthly. And I would bring in some, what I was trying to teach them was we can thwart these standards and these high stakes that we're being given. If you learn that whether you teach fifth grade science or, you know, 10th grade English, you are, teachers are artists. Like, you know, I don't care what you learned in licensure school, but you are an artist and an interdisciplinarian. And so that's what I'm going to teach you to be. And so I had like Claudia Rankin come in and teach them. And then I do a big public presentation. Then we had Sugata Mitra come in, who had just won the $1 million TED Prize. So he taught them, and then he did a big public thing. And then Ta-Nehisi Coates, I put in conversation with this cognitive neuroscientist, Matthew Lieberman, who wrote the book Social, about how we're hardwired to socially connect. And so we talked about, you know, is racism like a neural short circuiting of the brain if we're hardwired to connect? So these teachers went through that, and it was a fellowship program, and then we give them $1,000 at the end, and they do these incredible projects, and it was so exciting. And so again, an experience of knowing what education can be. And I'm just like, what it actually is, you know, being it in these independent schools that cost, you know, Brooklyn Friends School is almost like $50,000 a year. And then being on the other side, you know, in charters and publics where it's far less. There's so many problems. It's funny, when the pandemic came, it almost felt like there was almost like hope, weirdly. You know, because it was just starting to, like, you couldn't have people fighting against you. Like, you know, the faculty was very difficult at BFS, that's the short name for Brooklyn Friends School. And there was no time for petty fighting. It was sort of like, if I say this is what the schedule's gonna be, we just made 210 schedules, you just have to do it. And everybody was like, okay, because we have to do it. And what was beautiful is I got to say, you know, no more grades. I don't believe in grades, and I don't grade, even in college. So I got to say, no grades, pass, fail. Yes. It was an IB high school. So the IB, I pushed, I wrote letters. Finally, the IB internationally got canceled, but for the first time, like ever, the test. Yes, the AP test, canceled. SAT, cancel, you know, all the high stakes tests, cancel. I was like, oh my gosh, there's an opening. And everybody was just like working so hard, like boom, 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 like 18 hours a day, man. That 7 days a week we were working. There was no stopping. Until literally like maybe 7 o'clock at night, June 30th, when my contract ended, I was still working on what we called, virtual education 1.0. They're now at 4.0. They've gone through that many versions. But now, you know, now I'm fully immersed in, fully immersed, in, you know, in this Department of Education Department, they call it. I feel like an administrative court licensure coordinator. I mean, that's what it ends up being. The class, I would say, you know, like when I get to teach, that's the best part, because, you know, working with the students, and, you know, now they've all been sent home. We were sent home last Friday. Everybody started like moving, and everybody's off campus now. I was remote anyway, and will be again in the spring. And they are saying they're going to bring the students back. Let's see how that goes. But I will not be there. I will be working from this very computer, safe at home with my husband, who's also a professor, and then my daughter, who's at Pratt, and they're all remote too.
It's such a strange time, that which seems like no longer a very impactful thing to say. What are your biggest concerns right now for yourself and for your students and for students in your community and in schools where you've taught?
Well, I have to say that when you say community, like, you know, this is, so we have an apartment in New York City, which is part of the Mitchell Llama program. I don't know if you know that. It's like subsidized, you know that, right? And then we have this house upstate. I'm also a president of the board of Kite's Nest, which is in Hudson, New York. So it's a liberatory education center. I don't have like a community here. What I would say is that my larger sort of Black and Brown community, you know, my mother was Black American and my father was Cuban. So I am both, obviously. And I'm worried about that community. I've definitely gotten to an age where I am not less tolerant, meaning of racial discrimination, in that, like I will never let white people, neither at my office nor any professional place, ever, ever see me angry. Because I will never be that Black angry woman. I never, like, my mother was always like, you know, never, you save that for home, whatever, because once they see that, then they, you know. So, in fact, I'm always the very opposite. And there was a racial accost, I guess you could say it, because it was, I mean, assault at near campus of a young student, young Black girl, a few weeks ago, during the election. And three white guys said, you know, go back to where you came from, and if it doesn't go our way, watch out, that kind of thing. Then I met with other students of color and heard that, you know, they're used to white guys pulling up in pickup trucks and throwing their food at them. I am the only Black American, either tenured or tenure track professor in the entire college. And I'm certainly the only person of color in my department. And that has been extremely difficult. Brooklyn Friends School, actually, even though it was an independent school, you know, very high cost, almost half the high school was of color in students. And then so many of the adults, you know, my colleagues were of color. It's New York City. And there was a concerted effort too. So, but this is like, and working at SUNY Albany, you know, it's like all the kids from the boroughs, you know, it was like being in Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, and the rural dairy cheese upstate New York all in one classroom. It was beautiful. I'd have a trumper and then, you know, like a Jamaican immigrant, and I could bring them together. It was beautiful. Now I'm just, it's just all white. I think I have two students of color, maybe. Yeah, I have two. Yep, that's it. So I'm worried about I'm racially worried more so than I've ever been in my life. More so than I've ever been in my life. It definitely weighs down on me in ways it hasn't before. And I think there's something about age and holding it for so many decades and actively working through it, you know, because it's part of my profession almost, you know, that now I'm just to a point where I'm like, you know what? I retire from race and I retire from education. And I think we should do the education sort of this, what South Africa did, which was reconstitution. They just shut it all down. They were like, we don't care if you're a great principal, a great teacher, or whatever, you're leaving. Everybody's emptying the school. We're gonna mix you all up and send you to different places. Like, I just am like, when I say blow it up, obviously I don't mean literally, but I just think we need to blow the sucker up, blow education up and start over. Places like Kite's Nest are doing it right. But otherwise, it is a sad, sorry mix. It doesn't mean that there aren't like these great, phenomenal, incredible teachers who are critical pedagogues, you know, just really hammering it out. But dang, what they have to go through just to like be good teachers, like, jeez. So what you're probably hearing is, you know, just, and what, you know, I know I've been struggling with this, just profound disappointment in what I've dedicated my whole life to, and conflated with that on purpose is the profound, ugly place that this country is in terms of difference, not just race, you know, but, you know, gender, sexuality. And it's like my mom grew up during, you know, segregation, and she integrated actually middle school in Maryland, called Monkey, Nigger, all that. And I remember interviewing her and being like, oh, wow, I'm so glad my daughter doesn't have to live through that. And I'm like, I'm in another version of it, you know? Yeah, it's like a, when I say sophisticated, I mean, it's like a cosmopolitan version, you know, because it's so 2020, 2021, you know, doesn't look like it did back then. But her family was able to insulate the whole family, you know, literally behind a fence in the house, you know. There's less insulation now because it's in your work life, you know. It's, you know, it's everywhere. So
where do you find support? What have been your biggest supports during the crisis?
My husband and daughter, for sure. And an amazing therapist, I have to say. I mean, wow. Like, can't believe it. You know, I've been to many therapists, but this one's like, he's amazing. Originally from Israel. It's almost poetic the way he talks. And also, he's very intellectual, so I really like that. That has really helped, because you don't get to talk much intellectually when you're talking about licensure, you know, the CAP and the PSAT, PST and the SMK and the blah, blah, blah for the state and standard 1.0.2.1, you know what I mean? So there's not much intellectualism there. You know, a lot of, one of my best friends, you know, who's in California, Heather, she runs Key School. It's an independent school in Palo Alto. I'm doing some really inspiring work with them, and I talk to her a lot, and she's great. But, you know, it's interesting because I'm doing a project right now in two of my classes where we're making, and we haven't really thought of a name yet. They're like these boxes. But they're going to be digital. They're going to be like on this learning management software we use called Canvas. And in our talks, what we've decided is we're going to have like rooms, because we're making these boxes for teachers. And it's so that they can deal with what we're dealing with as teachers, as professor, and then as students. So you go inside a room, and like a student's like, one room will be like, kitchen sounds, which would just be the sounds of like clanging and cooking and familiar sounds. They were like, familiarity could probably help a teacher during this moment, right? Because it helps a student during this moment. And then in there might be an interview with like, you know, a mom, like this one student's mom while she's cooking. And we were just thinking about what would be the sounds of what we're all going through, the painful parts, the challenges, because they were like, we shouldn't shy away from it. But then what could be the kind, not soothing, but the sounds that remind us, that's what they said, that remind us that we are connected. That's what they said. They said, let's remember it's happening to everyone globally. Let's help teachers and students understand each other better and have that connection back. This isn't just a me thing, this is an us thing. That's what one of my students said yesterday. So I think, it's so weird, it's like that support just, you know, like what's support, you know, during this time when you're trapped in your house, not trapped, but you know, cause I'm like, I'm one of the smart ones. I wear the mask. I'm like, I don't mind. I'll stay here until it's, you know, all fixed. I'm not some idiot, but it's hard, you know, because there's no, there, just everything is different. That's exactly what my students and I were talking about. You know, everything is just different. What you're just used to trying to do to get by is different. I don't know that anybody will ever be the same, which is, you know, scary. I know I won't be the same. I can't even imagine what it's like to be around colleagues again. Like, oh my God. I mean, you know, I'm a person who really believes in being in the classroom and like you're moving around or whatever. And I'm like, now I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm terrified, not of disease, but just of, you know, those things called people or whatever. When we shut the school down on March 6th, I remember our head of school came in to the senior leadership team meeting and Spence had just shut down. It was the first independent school to shut down in the city. We saw in the paper and we were all like, oh, wow, like it's coming. And both my head of school and I were, I mean, dog sick. We didn't know we had COVID, but we were like death. And so, and we're, you know, everybody's there. It's terrible. So anyway, then she said, okay, so we know Spence is closed. Now Collegiate's about to close because there was a relationship. Actually, one kid went to one school, one kid went to the other school. Right. And so we were like, okay, there's this new phrase, abundance of caution. And she was like, what do you think we should do? And I was the first one to say, we got to shut it down. We're not going to make it. Like, we got to get out now. And then it's a Quaker school. So, you know, we're sort of like looking around the room, what's the sense of the room? And everybody's like, yeah. And she said, okay, by 6 o'clock, I literally left that room and I started walking each hall going to each classroom. All right, kiddos, this is really scary, but it's gonna be all right. But the school is shutting down at 6 o'clock tonight. So I want you to go to your lockers. I want you to get everything up, pack everything you think you could possibly need. And you will not be able to come back to the building, but we will be back in touch with you very, very soon, et cetera, you know. But that was like every floor. And, you know, there were a bunch of kids who were like, yeah. and some kids who were like, what the heck's going on? And then we worked till very late that night writing all these letters, you know, getting into high speed with scheduling. I put together a virtual hub website. I mean, it was like crazy. It was crazy. Then we just shut that school down. And, I got on the subway and the bus and then went home and went into my bedroom where I was, I didn't know that I had COVID, but I had been keeping myself in the bedroom and told my husband to sleep on the couch, and my daughter, she doesn't sleep in the dorms, so she was in her room. And I was so sick. Like I had no sense of smell, no taste for at least 3 weeks. No sense of smell, no taste. To be very personal, diarrhea for like almost 2 months. It was, I had a dog like this. Like I couldn't breathe, but I had to run, you know, I had to run the school. I had to run the upper school. And my head of school was in the same position. She had to run the whole school, preschool through 12. And we did it. But it was definitely, like, I can't believe, now that, you know, I can't, wow. Like, I led a school through the pandemic and I shut one down through the pandemic. Like, I mean, I lived through, I mean, like, you know, it, just to say it aloud, I'm like, oh yeah, right.
It must have been terrifying. I mean, at the same time, being so ill.
And not knowing, yeah. Wasn't until
I flag that it's, I'm so sorry, I want to flag that it's 3:55. I can't believe time has flown so much. But please, I didn't want to interrupt your thought.
No. I was just thinking that I didn't realize that, oh, I have all the symptoms of COVID until I came up. And I couldn't get a test because, you know, the whole Trump administration, nobody could get a test. So, it lasted from late January till end of April. No, not end of April. What's wrong? Late January till, end of April. Yeah. Like the beginning of May is when I started finally feeling better. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. It sounds like it was, again, I mean, a word that doesn't really feel meaningful anymore, traumatic, having to go through that. I am, well, because it's 3:56, I feel like I have a thousand things that I want to explore with you, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about anything that you would like to talk about, even if it's just something that you want to remember about these past several months. And if nothing occurs to you, that's okay. But this is your story, and I want to make sure that you're able to share what you'd like to share.
I guess I feel more firm about the fact that education just has to change. At the same time, I guess it's going back to where I started, this profound disappointment with it. You know, when you get to a place in your life where you've worked in a field and fighting so hard your whole life, and then you're like, wow, I don't think I can actually beat it. Like, I don't think I've got what it takes. I think the pandemic made me know that I can definitely lead a school. And I can lead it through whatever it goes through. That I learned. But it also crystallized for me, certainly what the advantages are and how we can sort of move in and, you know, create abolition within schools and all that. But it also crystallized for me how goddamn formidable the institution of education is in this country. And that leaves me with a profound sense of life disappointment. Because I've always said that we can change anything in the world in a classroom. I believe in the classroom, or I did. We can change anything. I'd say curriculum changes everything. And they put up formidable boundaries to do that. And then the whole fight that started, and I wrote a couple of articles about it, because I was staunchly against reopening, you know, like, instead, let's reopen Broadway and open those places and give those to the students, because there you can make them 6 feet apart, but don't stuff them in these old nasty schools where the ventilation systems are broken. And, you know, I was really against reopening, and I just don't know that people are gonna listen. I'm sick of having to prove what I know empirically, even personally, is the right way to do stuff in schools. And it seems like education is just a place where people wanna come and duke it out. I don't wanna duke it out anymore. Too bad you hadn't caught me when I was 30, 25 years ago, you know?
You mentioned a term describing work that's being done at Kite's Nest, liberatory education. Do you think that the crisis has opened up opportunities for non-traditional learning spaces like Kite's Nest?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, you know, because Kite's Nest has an, we have an outdoor space, we have a garden, et cetera. We have, again, this space. We've been able to use it in that way. And the, when I say outdoor learning, I don't mean like ropes courses, which is like what older people might think about, you know, outdoor education, but the ways in which we can use, you know, the outside, and the fact that now these are, what I'm talking about are these pockets of, like, you know, possibility, like, you know, part of liberatory education, and you know, this is what Kitesens does, is that you're very connected to the family and the community. And so now, once we shut down the schools in March, where did kids go? They had to go back home. You know, some of them went back to live in a car, you know, it depended. But suddenly we had to bring the families in. We had to find ways to connect with families. So that forces us into a certain position of being in community. And you cannot have liberatory education. You cannot have freedom and abolition in education if you don't include the whole child. And the whole child includes even mama who's in prison or whatever. I mean, so I think that that is There are some models out there, you know, that we should be relying on more. And I wish we were, I really do. But Kite's Nest really hit it out of the park when the pandemic hit. And even my daughter, who's at an art school, she went to their website and she's like, I started doing some of the things they had on their website because it was like cooler than what was happening in my classes, you know? I mean, so, but that's what happens when you have a community of educators who believes in the integrity and humanity of young people, their families, the community that surrounds them, each other. When you allow creativity to blossom, you'll hit all the subjects, I promise. I feel like saying to educators, they will be hit. They will learn the math. They will learn the English. And you know why? Because they will want to, because they know they need that skill to be able to do the next thing, this next incredible thing that a place like Kite's Nest is creating for them, you know? So I have said to Kaya, who's the executive director of Kite's Nest, that it's the one ray of hope in my whole life, is that place. It really is. Yeah, it's a site of hope. Kitesness is a site of hope.
That's wonderful. Well, it is 4:04 now, and I want to make sure that we have a few moments to speak after our discussion, our recorded discussion. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before I stop recording?
Just, I guess, I hope this isn't it.
Thank you. So if it's okay with you, I'll stop our recording now.